This program is brought to you by SoundsTrue.com. At SoundsTrue.com, you can find hundreds of downloadable audio learning programs, plus books, music, videos, and online courses and events. We also host the annual Wake Up Festival, a 5-day experience of transformation, held in August of each year in the beautiful Rocky Mountains. You can also join our free direct access membership program and read transcripts of all of the Insights at the Edge podcasts and search our collection of podcasts with now more than 100 episodes available. At SoundsTrue.com, we think of ourselves as a trusted partner on the spiritual journey, offering diverse, in-depth, and life-changing wisdom. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. You're listening to Insights at the Edge. Today, my guest is Sally Kempton. Sally is known both for her ability to lead students into deep states of meditation and for her gift of making yogic wisdom applicable to daily life. She has spent over 40 years practicing, studying, and teaching meditation and spiritual philosophy. A former swami, which is a type of monk, she lived and studied for many years with Indian masters and received training in the Kashmir Shaivism tradition. Which sounds true. Sally Kempton has created a new book called Awakening Shakti, The Transformative Power of the Goddesses of Yoga, which is a book that provides a practical guide for activating the currents of the divine feminine in every aspect of life. In this episode of Insights at the Edge, Sally and I spoke about how to seek guidance and blessings from a goddess. We talked about the role of imagination in invoking goddess energy, and also how every goddess has a light and shadow side. We also talked about the relationship between the invocation of goddess energy and the awakening of kundalini in the human experience. Here's my conversation with Sally Kempton. Sally, your new book introduces the reader to 11 goddesses of yoga. And here at the beginning of our conversation, I want to talk about what or who are these goddesses to you? I can imagine someone listening who thinks of goddesses as symbols or archetypes, or maybe a listener who says, no, they're actual real beings. They're actually real beings in non-physical space. So what are the goddesses to you?
Thank you, Tammy. And there's another question, why goddesses, but we'll get to that later. I first came across these goddesses, these deities, in meditative space. So I first came across them as energies, you know, as kind of feeling states that would appear in my meditation, not really visually so much as I would fall into certain states of consciousness through working with mantras or through chants that would bring this very palpable sense of a presence that was not me, that was not my normal meditative space, but actually had a kind of shimmering, ecstatic, and very individual energetic feel to it. And I, over years, I began to, let's say, be able to identify different qualities of energy, almost different personalities of energy, that would come up when I contemplated, you know, a different deity figure. So who the goddesses are to me primarily are these energy vortexes that are energetically so real that, you know, they kind of come into the space. Each one of them has a particular quality of, I would call it love and power that's different from others. And when invoked, they kind of show up in the field, and they can be felt by other people who are in the field. So their energies. And I do actually, I don't know whether the word is believe, but I have a very deep sense that they are actually real presences in a supersensual universe, in a subtle universe. But they are also, and that's part of what I've been writing about in the book, they're also, the word we usually use is archetypes. They're aspects of consciousness that exist in human psychology and also exist, you know, so to speak, cosmically. So, and once you start tuning into goddess energies, you actually start to feel the quality of one of these goddesses in the natural world. I mean, the classic examples are that particular energy vortex called Kali, whom people often experience like in a hurricane or in a very forceful aspect of nature, but who we also can experience as our own revolutionary impulses, our own a particular kind of strength in ourselves. So each one of these goddesses has a kind of signature that seems to manifest, in the natural world, in our psychological world, and as a conduit for blessing, for empowerment, for kind of divine grace.
So I want to take this slowly for a moment. Here you are, you're meditating, and there's a quality of presence or energy that emerges. And you mentioned that it's not that you had a visual experience of this quality of energy. It's not like you saw a goddess. How did you know, this is something that's not just something you could name with a word as a feeling that was moving through you? I mean, could you tell me the first time a goddess energy appeared for you in meditation and how you were able to identify it as a goddess?
Sure. And a lot of it has, a lot of my experience of deities has come about through, because I was a teacher for years in a Hindu-based spiritual tradition in which we would sometimes give courses and talks on deities, like on their mythological aspects or on their, on their iconography. And it would often happen when I was actually preparing to teach something on one of these goddesses. So I would have focused intensely. I would have been reading about Kali or Lakshmi or Durga. I would be contemplating the stories and the symbology, and there would be a moment. Well, the first time it happened, one of the first times it happened, I describe in the book. But the one that really blew me away was when I was doing contemplations on Kali, and I had certain ideas about Kali, as most of us do. That she's a kind of antinomian, wild, revolutionary, kind of left-handed tantric goddess who I thought of as kind of epitomizing the wild feminine in her most extreme form. And at one point, as I was sitting with the thought of Kali, and I'd been contemplating her for a couple of weeks, going for walks and thinking about her. And I was overtaken one day in meditation with this feeling of the fiercest love that I've ever felt in my life. It was as if a feminine love force just came into my body and filled me, and it was with a feeling that is so unlike my own personality. It actually felt like being possessed or taken over by another force, and the experience was radically, radically ecstatic, it felt as though I was being loved from within by a great power. My body began to shake and I began to cry, and the boundaries between me and the room started to dissolve, and it was literally in India they actually talk about something they call goddess possession that happens to people where it's like the energy of the goddess, the energy of deities comes into people. And for a certain amount of time, they kind of embody that energy. So that was my first experience. There was no visual, which is, at that time, I just never had visual meditations. I'm much more of a kinesthetic person. So it started a chain of deity meditations that has, this is in the late 80s, I guess. And ever since then, when I focus intensely on a deity figure, not only goddesses, but also, masculine deities, they kind of show up in my field, and each one of them is very different. So it's basically an energetic experience of an other. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like me. Mm-hmm. I think that most of us, especially people who meditate a lot, we have a series of let's say experiences and of deep meditation that are part of my personal field as a meditator. I'm sure of yours that are recognizable as Sally in meditation or Tammy in meditation. You know what I mean? So, and in my case, they're kind of non-dual, open, thought-free, witness type states. They're not particularly, they're not necessarily, full of, color and, horripilating dynamic energy. So when these deity energies arrive, they're very distinct from my so-called normal personal experience of inner states.
No, we started our conversation with what are these goddess energies, and you said, and we have to talk about why. And so I want to make sure that we include what you were pointing to there with this question, why.
You mean, why would somebody want to meditate on goddesses?
Is that what you meant?
That's what I meant. But I would also say, it's also interesting to kind of look at what the goddesses in the tantric traditions represent in the non-dual Hindu world. I mean, what they're, how they connect to the metaphysics of the tradition. But I would say, why meditate on goddesses, which is a question that that I have very much as I move around in the world of contemporary spirituality, that most of the people I know who meditate and follow the path that hopefully allows us to experience the ever-present suchness of our liberated self. Most people don't bother with forms. They tend to do self-inquiry practice or meditation on consciousness itself. And truthfully, that's kind of my own personal practice. So I got involved. I mean, I think that the reason why I have found deity energies, goddess energies, to be incredibly significant in my practice, and that I found them to be significant for people I've worked with and taught these practices, is first of all because they literally have a capacity to open up aspects of consciousness that we aren't normally aware of, and that so goddesses are literally empowering. They, you know, and as you know, that's part of the practice of the classical tantric traditions is that you, you know, I know in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, people have a yidam, or we would call it an ishta devata in our tradition, and you kind of find an aspect, a personified aspect of the divine that you can concentrate on. I mean, in a certain sense, that, you know, that deities are a cognitive focusing device, if you will, that lets you tune into certain transpersonal qualities that are maybe more difficult to tune into if you're trying to consider them in the abstract. So, and that, you know, and if, you know, as you know, in classical tantric deity practice, you actually do very elaborate visualizations and with mantras and their, and all the different things they have in their hands and their clothes, and, you know, and you kind of make the deity form a presence in your consciousness. And it's, you know, in my experience, because I don't tend to do it so much through visualization as through calling, you know, I'll ask the deity to be present, and ask in a, you know, it's with as much longing and desire as I can find in that moment. And it feels to me as though these energies, these deity energies are present in our field, in the field of the universe, perhaps in the field of our own subtle body, and that by addressing them, by calling on them, by repeating their mantras, we bring forth powers in ourselves that we can experience as helpful, as giving blessings, or actually as awakening capacities in us that we may not have been aware of. And it's it's a practice, I would say, that, you know, like all second person spiritual practice, it acknowledges that the divine is both inside and outside. So it allows you to actually befriend qualities of the transpersonal that you may not have been willing to allow yourself to possess. You know, like it's certainly hard for me to just, you know, to just affirm that I'm the incarnation of divine beauty, or that I have, you know, invincible strength, because I, you know, in my ordinary, limited Sally Kempton form, I don't. So there's something about calling on the, you know, the divine beauty of a transpersonal form, or on the invincible strength of a, you know, of a transpersonal form, a deity figure. Or for me, as a writer, I spend a lot of time asking for divine help in, you know, in helping me figure out what I actually want to be saying in an article or in a chapter. And it's, you know, it's been one of the ways that I find to overcome my sense of personal limitation is by calling on something that's without limitation. And, you know, and then kind of inhaling it and allowing it to take shape in me. So that's one reason for why goddesses.
This is very helpful, Sally, and I want to make sure to really ground it for our listeners. And to do that, I'm wondering if you could talk about a specific goddess that you have been calling on in the last year or two and really working with specifically, and how you do that and what kind of change occurs in you through calling on that goddess.
Okay, great questions. Well, the most interesting recent experiences I've had of let's say working with a particular goddess was in this book, because there were certain of the goddesses, you know, there are 11 goddesses in the book, and some of them, Kali, Lakshmi, Saraswati, are goddesses I've studied a lot and taught about a lot, and they're, you know, I've been interacting with them, so to speak, psychically for years. But there were some of them that I wanted to include, but who were really quite unfamiliar to me. I had never been initiated into their practices. They're tantric wisdom goddesses, so they're quite mysterious esoteric goddesses, but also very interesting and resonant. And in the process, I began to kind of ask for help in unlocking the mysteries of some of these goddesses that I didn't feel like I understood. And as I asked, this particular energy coalesced in my field, and it was the energy of a goddess named Matangi, whose her myth is that she was a human being who is the daughter of an elephant handler in the jungles of India, and she's a form of the goddess Saraswati, who's the deity of wisdom and learning and, you know, music, and who's a very beautiful, quite ethereal form of feminine energy. She's the one that you know, classical Indian musicians invoke before their performances, and students invoke before the first day of school. But I just was, let's say, I had an intuition that there was an energy that was going to help me write the book, and her name was started with an M, and I kind of went through various, you know, goddess energies with M names, and this was the one that kind of sparkled when I said her name. And so what I would do is I got a picture of her, which as far as I know looks nothing like her, but there's a lot of pictures of her. And I started doing her mantras every day. And I would do the mantras, and then I would ask her for help. I basically asked her to write for me, which is my essential, the way I work with deities. I kind of ask them to do what I have to do. I would be writing about one of the goddesses whom I didn't understand too well, and this energy would begin to come through my hands on the computer keys, because that's kind of how I function as a writer. It doesn't so much happen in the mind, it sort of happens in the interaction of the hands on the keys. And at a certain point, I would actually begin to feel that there was something coming through me that came from a higher world that was literally translating subtle energy, subtle knowledge into an accessible form. So in other words, I would be writing about one of the goddesses who was very mysterious to me, whose name is Lalita Tripura Sundari, who's a very queenly tantric goddess, very sexy, and you know, she's the goddess who's the deity of the Sri Yantra, the famous sort of diagram that leads you, you know, from the gross to the subtle to the super subtle. And I began to have images of how this energy operates in a you know, human woman, you know, that what it is to be exquisitely beautiful and, you know, and utterly powerful, completely confident, erotic and spiritual and executive, you know, to have that quality of the feminine. And I found that this energy was kind of enabling me to tune into Lalita and get inside her and describe her in a way that uh, that I I believe is correct, is accurate. You know, that I could begin to see women who embodied that quality for you know, in one way or another, and to be able to, you know, to create exercises that helped me feel her presence inside myself. So is that specific enough?
Yeah, that's helpful. What it brings up for me is this question of asking a goddess energy for help. And, you know, the traditional idea that you could pray and make offerings and ask a goddess for a boon. If you will help me write my book. And I can imagine someone listening saying, you know, isn't this just sort of acquisitive spirituality? I'm going to get what I want. And I'm wondering what you think is the type of praying to a goddess that is really heart-based and will sort of bring out the best in that goddess? And what's more sort of grabby, can't you just get me what I want?
Good question. So there are two aspects of this that I want to talk about. First, the essence of tantric practice is that it's a practice in which both bhukti and mukti, meaning worldly enjoyment and liberation, are, quote, allowed. So the sages of that tradition say, you know, you should ask the deity for everything, because the more you rely on the deity, I mean, this is very, you know, very second person devotional, and it's in every tradition, the more you rely on the deity, the closer you bring the energy into yourself. And, you know, just as, you know, the great contemporary saint, modern saint, Sai Baba of Shirdi used to say famously, I give people what they want so that they'll want what I ultimately have to give them. You know, that principle is very much a part of tantric practice, and it's misused, in certain corners of that world, for sure. But the way I've always sorted it is that I ask for things that are for the greater good, you know, that are for the benefit of other beings. I've never actually it's only recently I've felt okay about asking for you know, help with my health, which I've started doing. But, you know, when I was with my guru, he would ask me to do certain things that were very hard for me, that I didn't really have the talent for, if you will. And he would say to me, ask Nityananda, who was his guru, ask him to help you. So I formed the habit of asking for help from my lineage, you know, for things that were acts of service that I felt were beyond my normal capacities. And what I discovered was that when you're in tune with grace, that your capacities are much greater than, you know, than they are when you're considering yourself your ordinary bound self. And so basically, I would say the difference between acquisitive petitionary prayer and petitionary prayer that's sort of in tune with the will of the cosmos is that you're essentially praying for things that are going to help you do things that will benefit others, or that are for others. You know, that prayer for others, prayer for, you know, for things to go well for another person. Prayer for me, a lot of the way I pray is to really understand the truth in a situation, so that if I'm writing something or if I'm teaching, that what I'm teaching is coming from a place of truth rather than from my own opinions or my own views. So, and I actually find that kind of petitionary prayer is it sort of ensures that you're aligned with the higher powers, with the higher truth. And for me, making it personal is very important. I as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, it's difficult to, it's much more difficult to stay in tune with unmanifest pure consciousness than it is to stay in tune with someone or something that is touchable or tangible. And and for me, giving divine consciousness a name and a form actually helps me become more attuned to it.
And I'm curious, someone who's listening who might have the experience, I just don't connect immediately to this goddess or that goddess, but if I start using my imagination, if I start kind of telling a story, then that opens the gateway. And I'm curious, what do you feel the role of imagination is in invoking a goddess energy?
Beautiful question. Well, the ancients, of course, understood imagination as really the connection point between the human mental world and the world of higher forms, the archetypal world. By visual imagination or by invocation or by that experience of telling yourself a story. The mythic stories have so much capacity for creating a field in which these energies can appear. I mean my own sense of what the imagination is, other than being a higher faculty of mind, is that it is actually the great creative vortex out of which worlds are made. That in the ancient stories, the cosmic intelligence, the cosmic mind, kind of imagines a world of forms, and it takes shape, and all of this is the dream within the mind of the imagination of the cosmic being. I think that points to whether it's literally true or not. It does point to the incredible creative capacity of imagination, right? So if you're going to use your imagination, which I don't believe human beings are capable of not doing, then if you use your imagination to create beauty and to create sacredness and to create, compassionate visions, then somehow it seems that you are, you're influencing the whole field in a profoundly useful way. And what I would say to people who don't connect to these energies is to actually spend some time with some of these stories and notice that there are some of the stories, just as there are some of the myths that for some reason resonate with you on an imaginative level. And when you feel that resonance, then recognize that there's a lineage that each mythological structure is connected to a lineage of energies that, if you relate to it, it probably has something to teach you, something to offer you. So I've always found that the stories are a beautiful way into that, into a sense of the lineage energies. And of course, in many traditions, your teacher will sense the connection to a particular deity energy and suggest or offer that you work with a mantra that's connected to it, or do a visualization that's connected to it. So there are a lot of, there are different ways to test or sense whether you connect to deity energies. And of course, it's one path. It's a path that I would say, it's a path that eventually requires some form of initiation, whether it's initiation by a teacher or initiation by the deity itself, or the kind of initiation that kind of leaps out at you from the pages of a book, because it happens that way. But in a certain sense, you know, our spiritual practice chooses us. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
So we can trust that we'll be drawn to the practice that's useful for us at a particular time. It may not be the only practice that's ever useful for us, but I think that there, you know, I run across people a lot, especially women, but men also, who just have a, have an intuition that there's something in these feminine powers that has something to reveal to them or show to them, and you know, so they become curious, and you know, just by reading a book like this and doing some of the exercises in it, which are pretty empowered, I would say, you know, you start to feel the resonances. So everyone can go out and read this book and see which goddess you're attuned to. I'm actually kind of serious. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write it, was really to give people an accessible avenue into the goddesses of the Hindu tantric tradition, because they are such incredible vehicles for blessing. So I've tried to make them accessible, both, you know, through the stories and through human examples of what it feels like to, you know, kind of embody this energy, and through a lot of exercises.
You're listening to Insights at the Edge, produced by Sounds True. If you're interested in listening to previous episodes of Insights at the Edge, they're all available for free in a searchable database as part of our new Direct Access membership program. For more information, please visit soundstrue.com/Direct Access. And now back to Insights at the Edge. And Sally, you know, I want us to bring one of these goddesses into the space of this conversation. And to select which one, here's my question to you. My question is, here in the West, we have certain biases about feminine power. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. But we may not associate feminine power with that quality, or some other quality that's not really part of our current vocabulary about feminine power. And I thought it would be interesting to, first of all, ask you to name what that might be. What aspect of feminine power is under-recognized in the West today that we could find in one of these goddesses? And then to ask that goddess to come and be present with us in some form, to invoke her.
I think the obvious example is Kali, you know, who, although she's fairly popular among people, you know, cultural leftists, so to speak, she represents qualities that we really don't allow the feminine. You know, Kali's a revolutionary. She's fierce. She has fangs. She's destructive. She's naked. Her sexuality is unbound. She's uncontrollable. You know, she's all the things that nice girls aren't supposed to be, and that's also true in India. You know, calling a woman a regular Kali is not a compliment. You know, it usually means she's a bitch or a scold or somehow uncontrollable. So there is a kind of, there's a quality of of untamability and unstoppability in Kali that is not part of our vision of the feminine. You know, for example, one of the ways that Kali is seen is in natural disasters. You know, she's in the tsunami. She's in battle, which is not something that we tend to associate with the feminine. So she's a very scary goddess. And one of the things that I've found over the years as I've worked with people with Kali energy is that for many women especially, acknowledging the Kali-esque aspects in ourselves is radically liberating. So to look into your own wildness, your own anger, your own desire for let's say to dance uncontrollably or to run without limits or to say the things to the people who've hurt you that you never would say in civilized conversation. It's a deeply transformative thing to begin to tune into her energy, and the for many of us that Kali-esque quality is very deeply buried in the unconscious, and of course it's deeply shadowed quality, that kind of Kali-esque rage. But what you discover, or what I discover, I actually talk about it in the book, about a time in my life when I was very, very much repressing my rebellious and sort of antisocial qualities. I was living in an extremely, let's call it rigid yogic world. I was a swami, and all of my relationships were meant to be, calm and compassionate and loving and sweet, and so all the parts of me that weren't like that were kind of, repressed and in shadow. And at one point I started to get sick, and I would have these dreams about, strange forces trying to get out of my body. And I sat down one day and started to do one of those, writing with both hands dialogues, where you write a question with your dominant hand and then you let your non-dominant hand write an answer. And as I was doing it, I asked this energy, I was, what is this energy that wants to get out? And the words that came out were, "I'm Kali. I'm your wildness. I'm your rage. I'm your beauty. I'm your sexuality." And she just, she began to just write through my hand. And as she did, this feeling of enormous freedom and beauty and release began to pour through me. And, I would say that when you begin to tune into the shadow Kali energy in yourself, it requires some discipline, not to throw it on other people, which is what sometimes happens. But as you begin to get in touch with her, you start to see that the feminine is much more mysterious than much, much stronger, much wilder, much more able to contain apparently contradictory qualities, and then those, the quality of, let's say, ego-driven anger or ego-driven sexuality, can begin to be really transmuted into their, into their divine inner qualities, which are qualities of Kali. They're transpersonal qualities that are then available to you for deep work. rather than leaking out, you know, in recrimination and, you know, sort of abusive behavior and what Leonard Cohen called the homicidal bitching that goes on in every kitchen, you know, all of those qualities of the repressed feminine that, you know, that show up in unskillful ways because we haven't really learned to own our divine wrath, our divine wildness.
Now, in the book, you talk about how each of these 11 goddesses has a shadow side and a light side. Can you explain that in relationship, you know, using Kali as an example here? What's the shadow side and the light side?
Well, the Kali, of course, is a great example of an energy that's often expressed in shadowy ways. For example, one of my friends is a deeply compassionate and beautiful person. She's a psychotherapist. She's got an amazing gift for empathy. And every now and then she will have attacks of just terrifying rage, and they'll, you know, you'll be in the car with her and, you know, and you'll feel that something you've said has offended her, and the whole car will fill with this, you know, this intense anger, which in my case she doesn't express because, you know, we don't know each other well enough, but which in her family she often does express, and, you know, in ways that make people really walk on eggshells around her. And the thing that I've seen from knowing her is that side of her, that, you know, that crazy rage, which is her, the shadow of it, that there's a light side of it that's actually the same energy in which gives her the capacity to cut through bullshit, you know, to turn an entire room full of people who are, you know, are kind of not getting to the heart of something to actually take them to a very, very deep state of spiritual and psychological realization. And it's like that quality of being able to completely cut to the chase, to cut through the bullshit, you know, to find the truth. You know, that sort of in Buddhism, that sort of Manjushri sword quality. Can be turned against people in very cruel ways, or it can be used to you know, completely transform a situation and for, you know, towards beauty and truth. So, and I think with all the goddesses, you know, for example, Lakshmi, who's sort of everybody's favorite Hindu goddess, you know, she's the goddess of abundance and money and beauty and, you know, jewels and fertility and all these beautiful things. You know, her shadow side is this, is, you know, avid consumerism, right? So greed and you know, taking, doing anything for the sake of money. It's like Lakshmi turned towards the uses of the ego is, you know, and a big destructive force in contemporary society, whereas Lakshmi in her light form is the sense of abundance, you know, the sense of unshakable abundance that, you know, that makes us loving and makes us able to find beauty in everything and makes us feel satisfied with, you know, in deep ways with our life.
So, Sal, you made a comment that really struck me, which was how part of your intention in writing this book on these 11 goddesses is to give people a readily accessible tool that they can use to connect with these energies and to just put it right there for them. Here's the mantra. Here's the visualization.
Right.
Here are the stories. Here's your sort of self-starter kit to connect with this goddess, everything you need. And one of the questions I have is when somebody gets this book and starts seeing, oh, I relate to this goddess, I don't relate to this goddess. Out of the 11, there's only one I relate to, or there's two that I do and one I can't stand. How do you suggest that the reader actually engage? I mean, you could spend your whole lifetime working just with one goddess energy, potentially, or you could experiment with all 11.
Yeah. My suggestion in reading this book, and it's true of, you know, my meditation book as well, is that you read it like a practice. So, you know, read the chapter, and there are exercises in all the chapters, and there are mantras in all the chapters, and just practice them for a few minutes as you're reading. It's, you know, to practice a meditation on Durga for 5 minutes is not the same thing as doing a lifetime sadhana of Durga practice, but it will give you a sense of how this goddess feels, you know, of whether you connect to her. And what my suggestion is that you read the book that way, and when you meet one who feels especially familiar to you, and most people there's more than one, you know, because most of us have several goddesses expressing themselves through our personhood. You know, just spend a few days practicing with her. And yes, you're absolutely right. You could, and I hope that there are people who will. You could decide, you realize that you have a deep connection with one of these goddesses, and decide that you're actually going to investigate it. Spend some time meditating with one of the practices for invoking the goddess. Work with her mantra. And let her energy kind of flower in you. And in my experience, if you do this for example, if you practice with a goddess for a week, you'll start to get a sense of how her energy works in your life, and you'll start to get a sense of how to invoke her and when to invoke her. So that's how I suggest working with the book. I also, it is actually, the practices in it are really good for groups to do together. They're great to do with a partner or, you know, three or four people. You know, because all of these energies are showing up in our daily life. You know, once you start contemplating Durga, for example, who's a goddess of protection and strength, you know, who's a very accessible form of feminine energy in our time. You know, we know a lot of women who are manifesting, you know, the Durga energy, the kind of super mom energy. You know, the female executive, protective, executive energy. You know, you start to see her in your life and in yourself, and to recognize that there are certain circumstances in which it would be really useful to have a particular kind of feminine warrior strength at your, you know, in your field. And by meditating a little bit on Durga and starting to feel, because for me it's always a question of, like, you know, it's always a sense of actually feeling an energetic shift as you bring one of these goddesses into your field. You may not see her. In fact, most people don't. But generally speaking, you'll feel something shift in your, you know, in your subtle body, in your energy field. And when you feel that shift, you know there's been a connection. And at that point, you can begin experimenting with, you know, asking her to give you strength or to give you understanding or, you know, to let you feel love or harmony or beauty, you know, to help you work with a situation that's difficult, because all the goddesses, each one of the goddesses is particularly helpful in specific situations.
So your suggestion is for people to start where they're naturally drawn. And I'm wondering, yeah, you meet a goddess in the book and you think, don't really care, has nothing to do with me, not connected. Just move on?
Yeah, move on. When I was writing the book, I have a friend who has a book group, and some of the people in the book group were read, I think, 4 of the chapters. Everybody who read the book, for example, could relate to Durga. They're all professional women. Not only one of them could relate to Radha, who's, you know, the beloved of Krishna, and she's a very erotic sort of, I could call her kind of a teenage goddess. And, you know, and they just decided, okay, we'll skip through Radha. We won't go on about, you know, we won't go on with her. So I think that that's great. And what I've found is that at some point, every one of these goddesses, has an insight to give you. But if you know about all of them, then when that point comes in your life and you're thinking, is there some wisdom about the feminine that, you know, I can look to a particular energy for, and you think, well, what about her? You know, what about this goddess that scared the shit out of me when I first read about her, that I just thought was irrelevant to my life? So, yes, go where you're drawn.
I just have one final question for you, Sally, which is, your new book is called Awakening Shakti, the Transformative Power of the Goddesses of Yoga. And I want to talk a little bit about what this word Shakti means and what the relationship is between invoking the power of these goddesses and the whole phenomenon of Kundalini awakening in the human person.
Okay, great question.
It's kind of a big question to end on, but I don't want to end this conversation without talking about it.
So in the tantric traditions, and in the Indian tradition in general, Shakti, which literally means power, Shakti is the name for the creative dynamic aspect of the cosmic intelligence. So, you know, in the Indian tradition, the divine has a yin and yang quality, but the yin is the masculine, and the yang is actually the feminine, because in the tradition that I was trained in, the so-called masculine, and of course we're talking about a level which has nothing to do with gender, but the so-called masculine is identified with awareness itself. So, and the power, the creative power, the love aspect of consciousness is identified with the feminine. So if you think of reality at its deepest level as being, let's say, awareness love, then the awareness is the masculine and the love is the feminine, but the power is in the love side. It's love, it's bliss, it's creative urgency, what some people call the evolutionary urgency or the erotic urgency to become something, is Shakti. And in the tradition, that ecstatic urgency that's inherent in consciousness just becomes all these forms. So the tantric view is that everything that exists and doesn't exist is made out of permutations of this energy, this Shakti, and that awareness, is kind of present there as the witness and ground of all of it. So what Kundalini then is the microcosmic form of that creative Shakti, which exists inside the human body and in everything as a life force. So, the prana in yogic terms, and does our life. If you really get deeply into your own body, you'll recognize that there is a force that's living your life that actually, has nothing to do with your personal decisions and is even making those decisions before you know you're making decisions. And that's Shakti. And that's Kundalini. And when that energy is, it's it's said to, in our ordinary limited state of consciousness, it's said, you know, in a beautiful metaphor, that the energy of Kundalini is asleep. What that actually means is that it's functioning to, in what the tradition calls an outgoing way. It's functioning through our senses. It's making our mind come up with thoughts. It's acting through our, you know, through our bodies. But it's never looking into what we are on an interior level. And the awakening of Kundalini is the awakening of our capacity to interiorize consciousness. So, you know, from a tantric point of view, every spiritual awakening is an awakening of Kundalini. Because Kundalini is simply our capacity for self-recognition. But of course, there's another, you know, there's a form of awakening, of Kundalini awakening, that's very much about energy moving in the body and creates a whole series, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of manifestation of you know, radical shifts in consciousness and physical movements and purifications and you know, visual experiences. And that's the form of Kundalini awakening that, you know, that traditionally sends energy up into the, you know, the central channel in the subtle body and awakens the chakras. And Shakti, you know, the goddesses are deeply present in that energetic form of Kundalini awakening, as in all forms of spiritual practice. And in the tradition, every center in the body is associated with a goddess or goddesses who are the, you know, kind of the psychopomps, as it were, to use Jung's language, the guardian energies who if we, when we invoke them, they, you know, they can open our inner centers and open our higher capacities. So when Kundalini is active in the body, one of the gifts it gives us is a kind of heightened interior sensitivity, so that, you know, we actually begin to be able to see with what the Christian writers call the eye of the heart or the eye of the spirit in a much more concrete way than in ordinary consciousness. So that's just like the tip of the iceberg of an enormously complex topic, but essentially Shakti is Kundalini, and when that active aspect of Kundalini is awakened, it works in us, and I've talked about this a little bit in the book. It works in us in forms that are associated with different goddesses. So, you know, for example, when you're having an experience of upheaval and radical transformation, which often happens at certain stages of Kundalini awakening, it's said that the Kali aspect of the Shakti is working inwardly in your system, and when you have these, you know, great expansive heart opening sweet periods in your practice, when, you know, it feels as though, you know, the boons of the universe are being showered on you and everything you ever wanted is coming to you, these are said to be expressions of the Lakshmi energy acting in you through Kundalini. And you know, the goddesses are very, very much associated with psychophysical processes in our spiritual unfoldment, that as you get to know them, you can start to track them in your practice. And it helps you to recognize that you're not the only, you know, that your spiritual unfoldment is not happening it's, you know, it's not under your control. It's actually the unfoldment of powers that want to awaken as you, that have their own timing and their own intelligence and that you can trust.
Beautiful. I'm talking with Sally Kempton, and she has written an incredibly helpful guidebook to the transformative power of the goddesses of yoga, a book called Awakening Shakti. And 11 different goddesses are introduced very thoroughly, their stories, myths, beautiful images that have been hand-drawn by a gentleman named Ekabumi. And maybe, Sally, you can just tell us briefly about the images that are contained in the book.
Well, in goddess practice, one of the ways you familiarize yourself with deity is to look at an image. And there, you know, for centuries, there's a tradition of creating images for meditation. And there's a very specific series of icons and images and clothes that when they're brought together by an artist who's in touch with the deity energy, can actually help you recognize and come close to the deity energy. And there's a traditional way of studying and expressing sacred art that has been handed down from teachers to students for many generations, and they're different in different parts of India. But the artist Ekabumi, who did the sketches, who did the very beautiful line drawings in this book, has studied with masters of the tradition and works in the traditional way where he meditates on the deity and then draws it from a state of inspiration. So it's one of the along with the mantras and the stories, the illustrations really help you tune into the deity. So they're great meditative, great aids to meditation. They're also very beautiful.
Awakening Shakti, the transformative power of the goddesses of yoga, a new book by Sally Kempton. Sally has also created an accompanying audio program called Shakti Meditations, which are guided practices to invoke some of the main goddesses that are profiled in the book. Sally has also published with Sounds True one of my favorite books on meditation. It's called Meditation for the Love of It, Enjoying Your Own Deepest Experience, and an audio program that helps people start a meditation practice called Beginning Meditation. Sally, as always, wonderful to talk with you, and congratulations on the publication of this book. I think it is.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it is a beautiful, helpful tool for people. I think it's really going to make these goddesses accessible. That's a great gift.
Well, it's been a joy, and of course, working with you is always illuminative, fun, and something I'm very grateful for. So it's been a pleasure all around.
SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.